Ed Veesters is a mountaineer and the only American to climb all 14 of the world's 8,000-meter peaks, and he did it all without oxygen. Here with me to explain how he did it and how he's still alive is Ed Veesters. Ed Veesters, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So let's just get right into it. You were born or raised in Illinois, and I mean, what made you want to be a climber? I'm also from Illinois. I know it's not great for climbing.
Yeah, you know, I was, I remember as a kid, I started reading a lot of adventure books, Exploration and stuff like that. And the one book that really kind of inspired me was when I read Annapurna. And that was the book that was written in 1950, and it was the first 8,000-meter peak climbed. And I read that book, and I go, that's something I want to do. I was so intrigued by the whole process, the adventure and the climbing, and I said, I'm going to do that someday. And I just started reading more and more, and then I started going rock climbing up to Devil's Lake, Wisconsin. And then when I graduated high school, I said, I'm moving to Seattle to go to college because I thought that would be the perfect place to start climbing, you know, the Pacific Northwest.
So climbing, I mean, you've obviously, now you've basically, you've devoted your life to it. I was talking to this guy, Pete Pensiers, recently, who is a cyclist, but he was able to ride and compete even while working a full-time job. At what point did you say that you were going to try and not just like be a climber, but have that be your life?
You know, it was, I would say it was in the late 80s. I had gone to college. I went to medical school to become a veterinarian. And then I graduated and I was heavy into climbing. And I kept kind of wanting to go on expeditions. But I also had a full-time job as a veterinarian, and the two didn't quite work. You know, if you want to go away for 3 months at a time, you're not really a good employee. And so I finally just at that point had to make a decision. What do I want to do? And in those days I thought, let me just go climbing for a few years. And I just kept climbing and climbing and climbing. And then I self-supported myself and, you know, worked as a carpenter. I had whatever job you can imagine. And then once I decided to do all 14 of the 8,000-meter peaks, I thought, I need to be a professional at this. And then I just started working with all the sponsors that I had and started to convince them, you know, that they should pay me a retainer to be their person. But also in return, I would give them my time. I would go to trade shows and sales meetings and help them design and develop. So they had value in that. You know, they weren't just sending me checks. And that took a long time. But I dedicated myself to climbing and then figured out how to support myself as a climber professionally.
And what was the first 8,000-meter peak that you climbed?
Well, the first one that I was invited to that I attempted was Everest, and that was 1987. And with the leader of that climb, Eric Simonson, he and I got to within 300 feet of the summit. And because of variable conditions and increasing risk, we turned around 300 feet from the top. And then I went back to Everest again the next year, didn't make it. And then the first successful 8,000-meter summit was in 1989, and that was on Kanchenjunga. That's the third highest peak.
Okay. My impression of Everest, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like, I don't know if it was like this back in the 80s, but like nowadays, it seems like you can almost just pay someone enough money to basically like drag you to the top. Is that true?
It's not true. And a lot of people think that. There's a lot of misconception, you know, because, you know, it sounds like, wow, for $50,000, I can pay a guide and he can drag me to the top of Everest. It's absolutely incorrect. You know, the clients that go to Everest, you know, although they're amateurs, I mean, they're not professional like me. Amateur doesn't mean inexperienced. And I think as soon as you throw the word amateur out there, people go, oh, they don't know what they're doing. They do. They're just not professional. They don't make a living as climbers. But these clients have typically worked their way up the climbing ladder. You know, they've climbed Rainier, they've gone to Denali, they've done Aconcagua with guides, and they have then the resume to legitimately try to climb Everest with a guide. It is expensive, and I think with that expense comes the expectation that, wow, you're buying a ticket to the top, and it's not true. You're covering costs. And the legitimate guide services that are out there, I mean, they're providing a service for these people, and they're also evaluating these people. I mean, if you show up and you don't have the experience, if you can't take care of yourself, if you don't have, you know, the honest resume, you're not going to climb Everest, and nobody can pull you up there, and nobody can drag you up there, nor will they, you know. So it's a bit of a misconception that anybody can climb Everest.
Gotcha. One of the things that was interesting about the way, and I think you did this for all 14 of the 8,000 meter peaks, but you climbed them with no oxygen tank.
Yeah.
Why?
To me, it was, you know, when you go to Everest or whatever, and the other 8,000 meter peaks, and you're using oxygen, you're basically lowering the relative altitude of the mountain. And on Everest, it's about 7,000 feet. And for me, it just, there was no intrigue with that. I thought, if I'm going to go to a mountain that's 29,000 feet high, I want to try to climb a mountain that's 29,000 feet high. I don't want to bring it down to me. And to me, the challenge was not just getting to the summit. It was more if I could get to the summit without oxygen. That was the intrigue, you know, to remove the oxygen, to take away all that extra stuff. And I promised myself if I could not climb one of these peaks without oxygen, I would not do it. I wouldn't climb it. So I had to have that hard, fast rule that was the way I was going to do it. And I didn't know if I could, but I said it's got to be this way or no way. And I think because of that, you know, commitment, I trained harder, I focused more, I planned more, and I was willing to suffer more. And in the end, it worked out.
Wow. Speaking of training, what kind of, I mean, obviously you do like climbing and stuff like that, but physically, mentally, what do you do to get prepared? Do you have like a special diet or how does that work?
Not really a diet. I mean, for me, everything in moderation as far as a diet is concerned, you know, just normally live healthfully. I just trained hard, you know, running 7 miles a day, 5 days a week, going to the gym, lifting weights 3 or 4 times a week, climbing, running, biking, hiking. And, you know, I typically had 8 or 9 months before an expedition to prepare. And for me, that was every day that I trained was money in the bank. Because when you get on an expedition, you know, you're going to be away for 3 months and you're not going to get stronger. And you're not going to get more fit. You have to be ready to roll. You have to have that endurance and strength when you go. And I think it was that focus that, like, you know, whatever I do today is going to be a deposit for what I need, you know, 4 months from now when I'm going to the summit of Everest. And that was kind of my motivation.
Okay. And after your first 8,000 meter peak, how long was it before you decided you were just going to do all 14 of them?
Well, you know, I climbed Kanchenjunga, and then the next year I climbed Everest, and then the next year I climbed Everest again, and then after that I climbed K2, and at that point I had the three highest mountains in the world under my belt, and I was so intrigued with that. I thought, wow, things are going well. I think I'm pretty good at this. I love it, and I wanted to have, rather than just a random peak after peak, I thought, why not just do something long term? And, you know, Messner had done all 14. So there was that package. Somebody had done it, but only a couple of people had done it. And for me, it just seemed like this really amazing project. And at the time, you know, when I decided, which was like 1994, I thought, it's going to take another 15 years or so, but this is what I'm going to do. And that's what I decided to do, and I never gave up.
Is there ever a moment when you're on one of these mountains and you're like, oh man, like not only did I not prepare for this, but I couldn't have prepared for what I'm facing right now?
I never had a moment where I felt like I was ill-prepared or not strong enough. My motivation for training was never to have that moment. And I can truly say that I never had the moment where I thought, I just can't keep going. I have had numerous times in the mountains where, the conditions were beyond my control. It was too dangerous. There was too much snow. It was too windy. It was too cold. Where the only logical decision, in my view, was that we turned around based on the risk. And when that happens, you make the decision that the mountain is trying to tell you something, and you walk away, and that's okay. I don't call those moments failures because I never quit for lack of wanting or trying. I always stopped and turned around because of, something beyond my control.
Right. On that same, was there ever a moment of grave danger, or what was, I know you're all about being prepared and,
right,
basically just evaluating risk, but was there ever a moment like a near-death experience or, that you're like, the risk was greater than you had anticipated?
Yeah, there was, when there was an incident on K2 when I was with Scott Fisher, and there was a day when we were at Camp 3, hoping the next day to go to Camp 4, and then the next day to the summit, and a group was ahead of us. There was three people that day climbing to the summit. They climbed very late into the day. They had to spend the night out near the top. They came down very debilitated, and one of the climbers needed assistance coming down. And so they radioed down to Scott and I and said, hey, we need some help. And so Scott and I decided to go up and help them. And it was not a good day for climbing. It was snowing. It was avalanches. And it was actually during that day when we got caught in an avalanche and were nearly swept down the mountain. During the avalanche, I managed to stop myself with my ice axe, and because I stopped, I was roped to Scott, and then when I stopped him as well. And that's the only time I've been caught in an avalanche or had that, like, super, super close call.
Okay. And then Annapurna was the last of the 14 that you climbed. And you had gone up twice to see if you could do it. And you almost didn't go back a third time. What compelled you to go back?
I almost didn't go back that third time because every time I went to Annapurna, I knew the history and the objective risk was so off the charts. I thought that, no matter how good of a climber I am, I can't control that risk. But then I thought, God, I need to be there. I need to go to the bottom of the mountain and at least, watch it. Because if I don't go, I'll never know. And I didn't promise or I didn't tell people that I was going to climb it. I just said, I'm going to go look at it. And we're going to kind of suss it out. And we're going to evaluate it. And we're going to see what the conditions are. And with that in mind, we went for the third time. And we hung out for a week. And truthfully, the weather, the conditions, the mountain seemed completely different. It seemed legitimately safe, 180 degrees different than what I'd known it to be before. And only then did we decide to go for it, and conditions were amazing. So, you at least got to go and look at something face to face and be there if the opportunity presents itself. And had the conditions been just as bad as they had been, my previous two times, I would have turned around and gone home. And I don't know if I would have gone the fourth time. Thankfully, I don't have to think about that.
Yeah, just for people who are listening, who, when you say the objective risk was so high, it's something like 1 in 3 people who try and summit Annapurna don't come back down. So it's
right,
very dangerous mountain. But
it is.
What I thought was interesting is you went with your partner, who you trusted, climbing partner, and but you also met some Italian guys on the way who were both named Mario. And what made you want to climb up with those guys?
Well, when we arrived, Vaca and I, we had arrived we had already been on Cho-Oyu, and my idea was to go to Cho-Oyu, which is another 8,000-meter peak, and acclimatize there because it's much safer, and then go to Annapurna. So by the time we got to Annapurna, Vake and I were very acclimatized, and when we got there, we met a team of Italian climbers, you know, very, very competent, and they'd spent the equal amount of time on Annapurna that we had spent on Cho-Oyu. And they were waiting, as we were, for weather to go to the summit. And then they said, hey, why don't you come with us? Let's join forces. And so we did. And then we kind of hooked up with them and worked our way back up the mountain with this team of Italians. And they were amazingly nice people. Yeah.
The right before you were able to make your sort of last push to the summit, you all got snowed in. What was that like?
You know, we were up at high camp and hoping the next day to go to the top. And here I am, one day from climbing Annapurna finally, and one day from away from climbing, you know, my 14th peak. This would be the end of an 18-year project. So I'm like, I really want to go tomorrow. And then the winds came in, and it blew so hard and so steady that we were stuck there. We couldn't move. I mean, we could have gone down, but we thought, man, if we go down, you know, we're never coming back up. So we decided to wait. And, you know, waiting in a tent when the wind's blowing and it's trying to break the poles, you know, it's kind of scary. But the hard part is that we didn't have much supplies with us, and the critical point was that we were eventually going to run out of fuel. And if you don't have fuel, you can't melt snow, and that's therefore you can't have water, and therefore you get dehydrated and you can die. So fuel was our limiting factor. And we waited for 2 days, and finally on the third day the winds died and we got to go to the top, you know. So if you can hang out, and if you can be uncomfortable for a while, and if you have the patience, sometimes you can get lucky.
Yeah, the I should mention, just because I heard you talking about this in a TED talk at one point, but the way you couldn't hear the two Italian guys in the other tent over, but you could smell the cigarette smoke, so you knew
yeah.
they were doing all right. I mean, just this image of these two Italian guys at 8,000 meters. Smoking Marlboros and cutting up salami is beautiful.
Yeah, it was very funny.
Once you get to the top, though, and you've accomplished this decades-long quest, what is that feeling like? Is it even possible to describe?
You know, it is. For me, it was a dream come true moment, you know. To have grown up in Illinois, to have this vision as a kid to maybe climb one 8,000-meter peak, let alone all of them, and then to do it, to somehow have managed to get through 18 years of it, you know, hits and misses, financial issues, all that stuff, I felt really satisfied and proud. You know, not that I cared if anybody else cared, but for me, it was an amazing moment, one of the high points of my life, absolutely. But I always tell people, you know, on the summit, I had to be restrained because I knew, you know, we still had to get down. And it wasn't until we got to the bottom where I kind of emotionally could, you know, let down my guard and say, I did this. I survived it. And for me, it was, something I truly enjoy doing, and it was a big part of my life.
After that incredible decades-long journey is over, I remember listening to this guy, Andrew Wiles, who is a mathematician. He solved like Fermat's last theorem. That was his lifelong quest, and he was in tears saying, like, nothing will ever match that moment when I thought of the proof. As someone who's completed a lifelong quest yourself, do you ever miss that questing, or I mean, how do you move on with the rest of your life?
Yeah, you do miss it. I mean, when I came down and then over the next few days, I thought, wow, I am elated with what I've just done. But I'm also sad because now this thing that consumed me, you know, that took large parts of my day, thinking, planning, training, doing, it was gone. And so there was a big hole in my life. And it took a while, but I had to kind of just say, you know what? Be happy, be content. Don't try to outdo yourself. Don't, you know, people always ask me, what's next? What's next? There doesn't really have to be a next. I can't outdo what I did. And as long as I can look back and enjoy those moments and those memories, I'm fine. I do miss it, but you know, at some point you got to move on. And I'm good with that. And I could understand what that mathematician felt like, you know, being done and then saying, wow, what do I do now? But there's so many other things that you can do that and things that keep me occupied now. They don't have to be, you know, 8,000 meter peaks.
I don't want to take up too much of your time, so this will be the last question, but do you have any advice to young climbers or just young people in general trying to pursue these long-term dreams?
Yeah, you know, I've always tell young people, I tell kids, you know, live a dream. Whatever you think you want to do, no matter what people think, no matter where you're from, if you have a vision, if you have a goal, and if you have the patience and the desire, you know, go for it. You'll find the right people that'll help you along the way. You know, and don't expect it to happen quickly or easily. But because of that, enjoy the process. You know, enjoy the successes. Enjoy the days when you're not moving. And, you know, I have days where I thought, what the hell am I doing? I'm going nowhere. You know, I'm spinning my wheels. And I'm so glad I just kept plugging along. And things eventually work. You know, if you say something's impossible, you'll never try it. So the basic thing is just find something you love to do. Do it and just take your time and enjoy the journey.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Ed Viesters, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Ed Viesters, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. See you next time.